evening, everybody.
Hi there.
Hello.
This is called The Woes of T&D. And it won't mean anything to anybody who doesn't know anything about Irish politics, because it's about Audrey Flynn and
Beverly Flynn.
The Flynnacy dynasty holds us in thrall. Hotherick and Beverly always walked tall. He proudly proclaimed thee to be a class act, but revealed to Gay Byrne the things that he lacked. As commissioner in Europe, he should cut a dash, and running three households had needed hard cash. When Tom Gilmartin was mentioned by Gay, he denied he was given the sly 50k. When called on to give an account in the Dáil, they voted for debt, going against Dina Boyle. And so we move on to Bev versus the Bird. Charlie told of tax cheating that had occurred. Rathy Bev made it clear that she's done nothing wrong, just like Little Red Riding Hood skipping along. Those tax-cheating wolves had caught her offside. Undeterred, she had taken the flack in her stride. She sued RTE, who destroyed her good name. If her client had hot money, she wasn't to blame. But Judge Frederick Morris refused to agree. Despite her entreaties, he turned down her plea. She launched an appeal and went off to the Sun. The Supreme Court would surely not see her undone. Bev wasn't in court when the verdict was read. She and Dad were in Portugal, golfing instead. Imagine her shock when she lost her appeal. The 2.8 million fine made her head reel. That's what she would forfeit for being so rash. She swore she would never come up with the cash. Since then, she's been forced to drop 41 grand. The poor thing is Flynn skint and can't make a stand.
Next up, the mic, we have Aaron.
Good evening, all. I'm telling you a story. I always tell a story about coincidences, and something I can do as well. I moved to Cork in October 2005 with a backpack and no money, and got a job the next day and got sorted in Cork. And I was living in Cork for about 5 months, and at the time I was really wanting to read a book. I'd read The Alchemist in Newcastle about 3 times. Really blew me away, the book. I was thinking I'd really like to read a book that was similar to that. And so one day I was walking down Paul Street, and there's a second-hand shop on Castle Street called the Irish Cancer Shop. And in the window of the Irish Cancer Shop was a box collection by Paulo Coelho. So one cold Friday morning, I got to they have a sale on a Friday every end of the month for the window. So I got there at 6:30, and there was someone there before me. And I said to them, what are you waiting for? What do you want to buy? So they were buying a Polly book that I'd missed. Well, they were buying a Louis Vuitton bag, and there was 2 Louis Vuitton bags in the window. And this old man came over at about 8 o'clock, and he said, what was I waiting for, and what was the other people waiting for? And this told him they were waiting for the bags. And he said, I'm waiting for the bags, and my wife wanted these bags. She's been trying to get these bags for months. And the Chinese couple that were waiting, that I said that they'd, you know, been there since 6 this morning, because that's what they wanted. So what they did was really beautiful. She had a bag on her shoulder, a Louis Vuitton bag, and she emptied all of her stuff out of her bag and he put it into a plastic bag, and she gave the man the bag. It was lovely. Anyway, I waited in the queue and eventually got the Paulo Coelho book, and I thought it was the lovely experience together. Okay, fast forward on to 2008, and I really like the book The Alchemist so much that if I see it in a second hand shop, I buy it and I give it to friends or to people that I think it's and so from about August 2007 to about May 2008, I must have bought it about 10 times in second hand shops just in Cork, and I gave it to friends. And I was around Alan's house one night, and this is about June 2008, and he introduced me to a friend of his from France, a girl called Nad. And I was chatting with Nad and we talking. And I said something to her, she said to me, "That's very courageous." And I said, "Courage isn't necessarily something that you have in life straight away. I think courage is something that you develop over time." And then Alan said, "She's met Paulo Coelho." And I said, wow, you know, tell me the story. So Nad, to work in a hotel in France, and with loads of celebrities and different things, and she read various Paulo Coelho books, and she's done the Road to Santiago, which Paulo Coelho wrote a book about, and she was in Paris, and Paulo Coelho was doing the coming to do a book signing for one of the Davis books, which is called The Witch of Portobello. She saw signs for this book signing, and she went on the internet to find out if she could maybe find a club of Paulo Coelho so she could meet Paulo Coelho in a private room. So she got onto this website, and she was able to meet Paulo Coelho with a bunch of other people after the main book signing. And when she was there, she gave Paulo Coelho this letter describing like how this book had influenced her, etc. And she left her email at the bottom and said, "You know, in the future maybe we'll meet one day." And she got a text from Paulo Coelho saying, "I'm going to be in France I'm going to be in Brazil for the next 2 weeks. Let's meet up." And 2 weeks later, she met Paulo Coelho in a sushi bar in Paris. And he walked in in a black t-shirt, a pair of jeans, a pair of trainers. And I don't know if people know who Paulo Coelho is, but he has a little ponytail at the back of his hair, at the back of his head that you wouldn't see on the TV front face, but you see it from the picture. And she said when she was talking to him, she wasn't so impressed. I think she had this image of who he was as a person through his books. And she said she was trying to ask him questions, and he was always diverting the attention on her, and there was no real kind of conversation. It was almost, he was just kind of information about her. That night I gave Nad a backer on my bike home, and dropped her off at Turner's Cross. And so the next day I was in town, Alan's laughing because he took this thing about 50 times. So the next day I was in town and I was walking down Castle Street, the shop I was telling you about 2 years ago, and I walked past the second hand shop that I passed 2 years ago, and this again was the Paulo Coelho box collection in the window. I thought it was very coincidental that I met someone the day before I met Paulo Coelho, then something I'd received 2 years ago. That's the story anyway. I think coincidences for some people don't really ring true, because I think it's a very personal experience, and I mean, he's tarnished the story by telling. But anyway, get some poetry out of the book. Words connect, gather as cells of flesh. Bursting out the form, the baby is stretching the canal of his mother. The form stretches the creator's essence to the writer. We just did four of us before, we did a workshop with Martin. Incredible workshop, really. We learned a lot. For how to accentuate words, to try and get a rhythm within your words. So one of the exercises, he asked us to write some haikus to try and develop the haiku into a rhythm. So this is one of the haikus that I wrote. Two haikus, and I'll give you them. Wrinkle, crumple, sounds, lines on grain, people complain, writing out their hearts. second one is water rippling, crash, bang on contact, wet, fang, emerge and swim free. And that's all my quoting now, but one thing I'm going to read just to finish. I think this might be my last time that I'm going to be a poet for a long time. I'm leaving Cork in a couple of weeks, but so I don't know if I'm going to be here again after tonight. But something that I've read a lot, it's not my work, but I love it a lot. So it's called, this is a story that would be told to a lost child. What do you do when you're lost in the forest? What do you do if you can't find your way around? This is a real question asked by a Native American child in the Climax Cedar Forest of the northwest of America. This could also be a question asked by a street kid growing up in Cork or Newcastle or London. This could also be a question asked by someone who's struggling in the world at the moment with a financial crisis or whatever their current situation is. So the child asks the elder, what do I do when I'm lost in the forest? And here's the answer that the elder says, the elder gives. The elder says, stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here. Stand still, the trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger. You must ask permission to know it and be known. Listen, the forest breathes. It whispers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back staying here. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a branch does is lost in you, then you are surely lost. Stand still, the forest knows where you are. Stand still, the forest knows where you are. Stand still, the forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. You must let it find you. Thank you.
The woman who met Paolo Coelho is disappointed with the real life and success. Reminds me of the story of the Rolling Stone groupie whose ultimate aim was to get to shag Mick Jagger. And like for 2 years she was a camp follower, going to all the concerts, and she started off going to bed with the roadies, and each one she'd go to bed with, she'd imagine she was shagging Mick Jagger. And she graduated to the stage, she imagined she was shagging Mick Jagger. Then she got to sleep with two other members of the band, and each time she went to bed with them, she imagined she was shagging Mick Jagger. And eventually she got to bed with Mick Jagger himself. But shagging the actual Mick Jagger wasn't as good as shagging, imagining Mick Jagger in her mind. So as she was shagging Mick Jagger, she had to imagine she was shagging Mick Jagger. Okay, women, you're chatting too hard there. All right, I'm not going to read from my own work tonight. I'm going to read from a writer who's reading at Aiksha this week. Some of you arrived late, so I'll give you the spiel again. It's the Festival of Poetry and Fiction on the theme of humour, irony and wit. Some of you may belly laugh, some of you may smirk smugly. There should be something for everybody in it. All the events are free, bar the workshop, and there's complimentary wine with some of the events, so it's the perfect recessionary weekend entertainment. We have some of the programs, I don't know, for everybody, but they're giving away free in Waterstones and Tripfield and the City Library. So if you don't get one here tonight, you have no excuse for media interest, you can easily find one. So I'm going to read from the work of an English novelist called Dan Rogue. Some years ago he had a book called Anthropologies, published, which was 101 little stories about girlfriends. I'm going to read three of those little stories. The first one is Noise. My girlfriend had been unemployed for ages, but eventually she found some work in an office. Although I couldn't find the courage to say anything, I was worried that her new role in life would come between us. She's been there for some time now, and although she spends most of her working day furtively ringing me up and up to make kissing noises, I can't help feeling as though she's slipping away from me. The slurps from the other end of the line don't seem as passionate as they could be. It's almost as if her lips had other things on their mind. Pieces. They kidnapped my girlfriend and asked for an awful lot of money before they would even think about giving her back. I was grateful for the peace and quiet, so I wasn't in too much of a hurry to settle up. After a while, they started posting me little pieces of her, starting with the ear in the soap dish. For some reason, they aren't lowering the ransom. It doesn't make any sense. They seem to think by paying much for a girlfriend with no tongues, ears, nose or nipples, as I would for one with a lot of it still there. Special. My beautiful girlfriend and I are so at ease with our relationship that we feel perfectly happy to hold hands and kiss in public. When we see a person who looks a little lonely, we walk past them with our arms around each other, gazing contentedly into each other's eyes. If they don't notice us at first, we'll go back and stand directly in front of them, kissing passionately, sighing, and touching each other's bodies in the way only lovers can. It's so important for those people to see just how perfect life can be once you've found that special someone.
Jen, you put your name down in brackets. Do you still want to get up?
Yeah.
Jen.
I can't express how depressed I am. I have to follow it. Yes. I've got two for you. So I was lucky enough to go to Paris recently. And the time before I was very cranky about people taking pictures inside the museum. And so I was just sitting there appreciating the art. And I have this awful tension all the time about, am I going to take pictures of art and what's actually experiencing it, and all this bullshit. So that's my poem about this. It's called About Being There. In the Louvre, teenagers create documents instead of art, lifting the camera phones to get a picture of an old celebrity. Briefly, before turning to each other, kissing, jesting, swearing, taking up space adults cue and pay for. Certain I know more about how to be near art, I elbow these loud little lies to get to the front of where they are. I fold my arms to demonstrate how silence works. The Mona Lisa smirk. None of us take any notice. The other one is one of those poems we had agreed to with. You might know Persephone and Demeter. They're the mother and the daughter. The daughter was kidnapped and taken as a baby. And, I decided to write a poem where she wasn't kidnapped, she just wanted to get away from the world that she was in. Yeah, so it's based on that loosely. So it's called Rudeness. The poppy's lips promised escape, a verse in reverse. The roots curled like beckoning fingers. I sucked it, shaking the clinging dirt from the roof, and the ground dripped open from it. Through the gash, the dark man came, and I dove into his river, to my marriage bed. Neglect wintered the world behind me, above me. My twin mother's grief took every living thing hostage. Under world, I sucked pulpy seeds, nails hooked in the rind of my husband's fruit, juice seeping in sordid rivers down my chin. Witnesses would return to advise her. This is no kidnapping. Thank you.
Get your pints in now, forever. Drinks nothing. Okay. Next up, we have Niall Harris.
Hello, everybody. I'm going to read a poem called Bird on Cage, which I may have given you before, but I just thought I'd give it tonight because of that fantastic performance by Martin Dawes earlier. And it's just maybe a similar theme. I can't do the type of performance you've done, but I'll just try this anyway. Bird on Cage. Jazz. Black by Universal. A four-letter flurry from a New Orleans den. Music in a hurry to grab solace now and then. Hear that old sax wail, a scream from wretched folk, as strange fruit hangs on a twisted southern oak. And hate bears its fangs. Jazz, language of protest, torn and bloody ragtime, from the womb of dark despair. You can buy for a dime, play it without a care. Voice of a stolen people, bittersweet whispered soft in a brass-lined throat, and frenzy thrown aloft to reach the perfect note. Thrumming joy or pain, love child of the blues, jazz plucks the strings. Hearts lifted by booze while the fat lady sings. Jazz trumpets carnival, music that feels good as sin, catharsis for all the sorrow. I feel black under the skin. I live today, not tomorrow. Thanks.
I don't know, but a really lovely name, it's poetry itself, and Rosalind Bloom, please. Did you not hear that story, that the name Stu Blue called up on the internet actually calls up a porn website? So I stopped giving in to that name that was given to me. My real name is Suzanne, I'm called Sue, and Rosalind Blue is my pen name. And it gets a lot of people confused. Anyway, reading I go by Rosamund Blue. Rosamund Blue's sitting on a writer's block these years, months. But today, on the bus, I actually wrote a little poem. It was the first time that I was sitting on a bus where I wasn't bumped around the place. And the bus was quite empty, but it was the driving made the difference. The swinging bus. The bus driver is driving his bus like a lady, swinging her through the curves, swaying along the road smoothly, swerving round the bend, gently slowing, softly speeding up into the dance of the road again. A good pair of dancers, the driver and his lady bus. And right after that happened another little one, and yeah, thanks very much. And it's called, well, it doesn't have a title yet. The writer in me sticks his head out sometimes like nipples, or bubbles, and pop, gone.
Next up, we have Chris B. Parker.
three poems from it for you if you don't mind if I indulge. Now I know from looking around this bit tonight that some of you would probably be familiar with sitting at a pub late at night. Or at least know somebody who was at the pub late at night. So this poem is based on that. It's kind of influenced by a guy that I got to know a couple of years ago, and some of you might be familiar with his name, called John Cooper Clarke. And this is kind of in his style, and without talking about it, let's just read it. It's called The Knock. You're in a pub, right? It's late at night. Somebody in shock, sitting out of sight, the astral is mighty nice, part of the spy, but on his side, the young girl cried. Where can we hide without being spied? As she tried to slide into the shadow of the lad whose fear he missed, he's gone for kids, and not just this, but further bliss, when she was pissed out of her mind, how you behaved the barman days. You can't be saved, and I can't save the drink like gave, I'll have to wave goodbye. And if you drink and drink and drink and drink, don't even think, just think the fucking drink without a clinch. Don't pause, don't pick an eye, but get them down them, stomp them, drown them, crowd them, not sit around them, pour them, roll them, don't store them, throw them, catch them, crack them down and hatch them, use them, lose them, don't balloons them, bones them, up them, stop them, stop them, stop them, don't skip them, sit them, sit them down, or one man can't shut up this shop. I'm for the chop, thanks to a cop on everyone, this isn't fun, I can be done for serving late, I hate to say it, but I can't wait, because my fate depends on weight. This ain't a nab, or a guard, a grab, or a backstab. Someone caught a fucking cat. You're a corvid. All this dog is having a corvid. Don't worry. No worries. Sorry. Moving on, just this poem is actually inspired. I come from a generation where we didn't have taxis or school buses, we walked to school. We learned more on the way to school than their farm school than we learned in the fucking place. I'm going to keep it kind of lighthearted with this as well. This is actually a poem inspired from my childhood, and it's about sex. Not exactly Shaggy McJagger, right? For gay sex. Great. On the street. A dog named Jack and a dog named Jip. Lay on the street one day. Says Jack to Jip. Can I have a sniff? Says Jip. Yeah, sure, get the way. So Jack released now check the other dog out in the area under his belly. And the more that he moved, his cold nose about, the more juice legs turned to jelly. Now his favorite confide that was into his drive, Jack undertook the occasional lick. And his whimpering crying very clearly implied this was better than she had a mistake. Then quietly Jack raised one leg in the air, took up a position behind. To his friend he declared on that thoroughfare, it's me birthday today, would you mind? You only asked for a sniff in a good natured jiff, you never said nothing about hopping. But the sniff was for rhythm, singing your stiff, but I give you 3 minutes of bumping. That they suffered no nerves was plain to observe from the two kids' merrily wagon. A passing by, had to sidestep and swerve around the two happy dark shagging. I've been sowing the street around people's feet in pursuit of their sex-driven action. They cause shoppers to stop at their tracks on the street, take note of this frantic distraction. So the drunken old dog rushed out of a pub, boy, Jesus, said he, that's what this is. I was leaving that pub to purchase some grub, but I think I got home to the missus. A priest cycling past gave an audible gasp as he rounded the corner upon them. It's all right, son of white, said a man with a rasp. So no fear he's using a condom. Then the young girl in love cried, heavens above, Lord God, I'd be ever so grateful. If only my dog was as good with his stroke, by Christ I might even say faithful. And a young little lad in the arms of his dad became immediately funny. To the joy of the crowd, he shouted out loud, look daddy, it's not you and mummy! 3 minutes went by and I proved that their boy, and it wouldn't have the push of his luck. And that's probably why at the end of his journey he found to his grief he was. The more that he tried to become untied, the more he stayed stuck in the end. Well, that's great, said his mate and sarcastic aside, so now you're my very close friend. They wriggled and squiggled while half the town giggled, but they stayed found by that cruel erection. And in the middle of the jiggle, Jack found he so wiggled that he stayed in the opposite
direction. For 2 quarters of an hour, they were stuck in the spot. By the time you're fighting and jeering, like a multitude of heads in a blade running out for problems to do with the steering. And the young man suggested, and the prince uncontested, that the doggies be given some drink. He said, I believe, and my wife would agree, that booze caused the wanted shrink. The offer was whiskey, but the dog sound from frisky. The operation was gentle and quick. But beware of the danger when you leave a stranger at the side to have sex in a gym. Crouching on my knees, watching chips and processed peas, leave with peanuts from the keys. I should be in this bed, but that's where it does warm inside my head, and it's already sprayed. My guts and I are parting, and my ass is starting to start, and I think it's only starting. Here comes the chicken curry, and it's in an awful hurry. I knew I'd be sorry. By the time you're on much fun, though, I only went for one. Now my belly's on the run, and stuff I laugh, I want to play, and things I can't believe I ate, and never to evacuate. Every colour wants to leave, like give another heave, and it's running down my sleeve. I only had a turd, a thrust, and now my head is fit to burst, but my bowels may get there first. My past is leaving me behind, I'm getting cramped and going blind. Oh, the Christ in God be so unkind. Last night is passing by my throat, and as I need to watch it flow, I'll never drink again, I know it. No, I'll never drink again no more. No, I never will, now I know the score. If only I had known before. Who? The lad at the door. You sure?
A really good friend of mine, and she's reading the first time, and Steve Leonard, so please welcome. Dear these lovers from stage fright, these are my twin sister's poems. I write poetry and I'm an artist, and she's an artist and a poet as well, but I concentrate on art and she concentrates on poetry, so I'll just read them first. And if I die and fall on the ground, I'll pick myself up. Oh shit, I'm suffering from stage fright. I'll make it better. Okay. Mother Mary on our windowsill. Mother Mary on our windowsill. Feels the heat today, after the dripping wet summer. Mother Mary on her windowsill feels the heat underneath her veil of silver, beneath her porcelain frame. She begins to shake, her heart beats, the snake is out from under her feet. She gathers its immortal coil, stretches it up in the sun, and together they greet the day as one. Mother Mary on her windowsill feels the heat, but retreats back out of the daylight into her shell. No reporters, Holy Joe, mass scores, or chippy vans needed around here. She's back smiling at my washing up. Well, she may well smile at my washing up, sun dance and shake, with her snake all she likes, but that Mother Mary, in her tiny cosmic trance, is such a lazy ass that she's never once lifted a finger around this bloody house. Dot to dot. 7, 8, 9, 10. With a tiny pen she draws a dog out of the page. At her trusty maze, and when she comes to a stop, the picture is complete. She moves along, satisfied, to the next sheet. Now, when the dots are large like stars, like rocks of friends, or landmarks blotted in a cultural scape, the story never ends as I sculpt and mend my head around each line I join from dot to dot. But somehow I have landed myself at this minute on a dot like a black spot, a full stop at the end of nothing, and nothing is complete or can be done. I'm desperately trying to draw the next line, but the page is worn with the marks of the searching and the dots are moving further away. at every push of my pen. I wish I was 7, 8, 9, 10. She draws a bird out of the page at her trusty age, and when she comes to a stop, the picture is complete. She moves along satisfied to the next sheet.
It's very short, and it's completely mad, but it's okay. The ashtrays are all full, there's no one's empty them. We are locked in romance again, tired of seeking zen and found uncurt, suffering swollen lungs or leaning dangerously against closed doors, chattering and chittering in streets and crawling on all fours. Alright, that's a very short quote. This is an old one, I just managed to remember. I basically forgot to bring any notebooks to any phone. And I have an A written before I realized it. So this is called Cork Life. It's a very, very old poem, but I've been in Cork for a long time, and I quite like it. It's a grand spot. Right, so this is written down on Sullivan's Quay, and there are two benches over, there's a little footbridge there, and it's very nice. The last two benches in Cork City, my God, they've taken them all, you know, and they've given us stones to sit on, and you can sit on the pavement, it's the same as sitting on a stone. Both benches are made from timber, and they're a little bit less unwelcoming. So anyway, two wrongs, they don't make a right all the time. So let's have a look. The suspension of time as the builder drops the plank from a great height. It seems to linger, indifferent to the force of gravity. Sailing slowly downward, it disappears from view. The cap of noise and afterthought, echoing down the street. Across the lee to where I sit, idling away another plastic. That's an old one. That's perfect. And the last one is just one out of memory, and it's Rudyard Kipling. I quite like Kipling, you know, and he's a bit of a dastardly fellow. But you know, his views wouldn't be accepted today. But he was a product of his time, so we have to forgive him. But he used to be a great poet, you know. He was the master of the work. And this is from Kim, and Kim is a great poet, you know. So you should all read it at some stage. He's a great poet. And I'd not give road to an emperor. I'd not give way to an emperor. I'd hold my road for a king. With a triple crown, I'd not bow down, but this is a different thing. I'll not tarry with the forces of air. Sentry, pass him through. Drawbridge, let fall. He's the lord of us all, the dreamer who dreams him true. So that's that one.
I emerged from the breath canal of a dark lake. In a drawer of blunt instruments, I lay, leaded by the first probing finger. I snip, I sever, I slip, I score. I am invincible, position seems to recall. I have sisters who paint for a living, or crocodiles stealing heavy metals. They crunch at the skirts of women. I love that long-haired girls waving their rope names on their backs. I want to unburden them to a choice that I desire most, the mate in all its simplicity. I have French dreams of bloody paperback. Sorry, that was too good. I love that paperback. A trumpet. This happened when I was a child. A jackdaw came down our tube in the bed. Jackdaw, twofold, vortex four, claws, claws, down grass tumbling into grapes, swaps the wings, claws, scroll the barback, black and black afterbirth, great missing. Bead eyes blinking, she plucks the blue window void. A turbulent takeoff that drops black snow, pink forest on the white bed, bludgeons the blue red, smearing a bunker, falling, falling, cobbles under the bed, cheek on the flat, flat moving. Five for you. This happened to come from a large family and the youngest, so there are lots of stories floating around, but it didn't happen to me, but it happened on our house. Cyclone. It burned in the night sky like a flare, but we lived miles from the street. I saw them scraping on the roof fence outside to find something blinking in the haggard, on and off under red eyes. We climbed it with stones, part of it from the distance of a long stick. Suddenly it dimmed and died. In the morning we found a flat balloon like an afterbirth attached to a tin can that read radio phone. Father said it had held fast forecasts of possible storms, even cyclones. It also read return to the above address. We looked up into the endless sky. One more then. Let's see. The combine raised into life, chaff flying from its tail. It turns to face the standing beast. The worm rotates, caress of tongue to ear, then blade levering at the feet. For its panic in the hedge, our small wings lift in the faint breeze. Rabbit pelts stretch on stubble rack. Nate means the shorn seed of bristles in the blood-red heart.
And congratulations also. I've just been told that Marie has won the Listowel Prize for her poetry. So that's next up we have Seamus Harrington.
Thanks, Rosie. History made tonight. Two giant winners. Picks us up with a giant fish. The lightkeeper. He met her at bridge in Tranmere. She hinted, no more solitaire. One gin on the rocks, she loosens her locks. Her flesh had a circular stare. By noon. Cocooned in a gown of dragons, staring, he sits in the hallway, right thumb on a rim, Morricone fading away from the remote day room TV. The other one, cumbersome, dissecting his cardigan, a sandal foot on each wrist, a waft of brown soda, pungent and poignant as cordite. Unaware of the danger, a patron at peace with the world, plods between the park chairs, puckers his lips, pockets a tissue of teeth. Kaleidoscopic wall hanging, stained slash of sunlight, Celtic, sacred and silent. Unblinking, they face one another. Who'll draw that first bead? 20 chrome reds apart, Derringer still trousered. A clumsy bedpan bongs, clear as an angelus bell. Two right hands lift as one. There was an old man in Ringsend. This diary his missus had penned. A lover with style goes that extra mile. So far, I don't have to pretend. Well, that was Morse code, SOS. Again and again, faint but clear, clear as the luminous frost, clear as the starry heavens, the message repeated in hope. Repeated in hope, repeated in hope, message repeated in hope. Much, much too late for too many, yet due to Morse code, hundreds of souls are plucked from the icy brink. From the icy brink, from the icy brink, plucked from the icy brink. Again, Marconi's newfangled device responds in disbelief to the rescue. In disbelief to the rescue, in disbelief to the rescue, responds in disbelief to the rescue. But wireless history was made and quickly forgot for saving that small ship, SS Mini Haha. Thank you.
I nearly skipped you, Reed. I skipped the name on the list somehow, which would have been an awful mistake to make. This Reed is wonderful. So please welcome up Reed Buckley. Thank you.
It's called False Truth. For those who put little value on truth, she'll speak with whoever smiles at her. Press her red lips to your forehead, smearing the lines, the documents, the testaments that she finds there. When she takes blood, she may forget to mention the stain. Slap your arms to start the flow that fits and stops and starts, till your red blood spatters her white coat and she sends you the bill for the laundry. False Truth is an elegant dancer. Riding against walls, she can slip in a beat into corners, hiding in strobe lighting and false eyelashes, some white glare of her sister's pale face. She is a charcoal drawing that will descend into dust under scrutiny, to reappear on the wall as the cover of a searing grey bone, a description of a feeling never felt, a caricature of herself with lips that would leave mountains. One cannot fight a false truth with this. She is always surprisingly strong, striking from under a cloak that makes her invisible. When your hand does slap her face, it's cold glass, a mirror that will explode in on you and run like water off her own body. She is the fairest of them all you'll have seen without her makeup. The price of King Solomon's wisdom can be falling into the mind without her white hand of comfort to stroke your forehead as she takes the words and the breath from you. Avert your eyes for a moment. Take your fingers from the strands of her hair. Resist the urge to take her in your arms. Down comes the house of cards at her. She will melt like the snow in the sun. Walk out the door to the hallway in which a girl in rags sits with her pale face downcast. She will not be a virgin. She will not have a crown. But she has waited a long time, traveled through black tunnels to find you. Without words, take up her suitcase and walk with her up the steps of your house. And with a white band on your fingers, lie down with her like it's the first time always. In the morning, the sun will be a Friday that swims in a mackerel sky, and there will be light beneath all the door frames.
Thank you, Reid. And next up is Miriam Casey.
Yatun's soul is master of his mobile home and never fears the full fragility of a carbon cavern. He possesses the passion to span beyond six-figure generations, stretching the nucleus of history. He looks at the thorns that pierce them, not in terror, but to analyze their teeny depths. I accept his smile to display or defy the flaws of his journey, for he has not put God in trial, but calmly reaches for himself.
Next up we have Anita Daly, please.
This is about, I was working at music for a while and I wasn't really very good at it, but that's why I moved back into writing. But the guy that it was just, I got to know a lot of musicians and to appreciate them and to learn about different instruments. Okay, this is about one man who sung very well. Naturally, you could have been an opera singer, but your home was from a different part of town. Did the others in our music class have their breath taken away too? That tiny burst forth in power, a song from the student's songbook. No less entertainment for that. Vocal chords with strength and branches. Melody rising and falling, swelling out fast tune.
Two readers left out are on the book, Alan Shipley and Alan Coakley. So I guess we'll go with Alan Coakley, who's the first on the list. Here we go.
I've been 10 minutes blind there. I'd love to read, but I wonder if there's any poetic life to carry on to the point. I'll leave that next week. So I read a short poem, and before I read it, my daughter had a blessing ceremony on the beach on Saturday, and it was absolutely beautiful. We made a fire, we were gathered around the fire, and we made blessings. Everyone came and gave their own blessing, and it was really beautiful. And I was thinking to myself just there that how beautiful it is to bless, and we don't bless other people very often. We've outsourced it to someone in the community, like a monk or a priest, but I think we should reclaim that power and bless each other more often. So this is just a short poem I wrote for my daughter, which I'll read. You came a surprise harmonious chord among our faltering adult melodies, stabilizing. I have not yet fully found my adult feet. My melodies are not always tuneful. My words often discordant. And your every cry is harmonious. I could tune my life to it like your mother, who sings a melodious tune to your gentle beat. Sleep, cry, smile, and eat. Come on.
I'm always amazed that Seamus has limericks. He's one of the few people who writes limericks, and I have hundreds of them in the back of my head, but the only one I could remember when Seamus was talking was the Cork one about there was a young queer from a prune brought a lesbian up to his room, and he argued a lot about who do what and how and with which and to whom. That's not what I was going to call it. It gets worse. Right. This is a sad story called The Troublesome Young One. It's not personal. There was once a troublesome young woman whom her parents called a little bitch. Others called her other things, but as her parents loved her dearly, it was enough to call her a little bitch. And because they loved her dearly, they did not throw her on the street, even when she constantly stole their credit cards, crashed her mother's car, ripped her father's clothes, called them stupid fucking wrinklies, and acted in general... general, well, bitch! But because they loved her dearly, they would do anything to help her, and even went so far as to bring her to psychiatrists. It's penis envy, he said. No doubt about it. I've seen it many times before. Young women of our age all suffer from it, even if they don't admit it. And just because they don't admit it doesn't mean they don't suffer from it. Nothing here that a good man and a little bit of plonking will not cure. Because they loved her and because they were paying good money to psychiatrists, they let her out about town with as much money to visit the best nightclubs and stay in the best hotels as she wanted. Now, not that she needed any urging or advice about where to go, but it was nice to be able to do so with her parents and psychiatrist's permission. So she'd have all the time with big, hunky, macho, muscular types and long, wiry, athletic, white freaks and flashy, moneyed, long practice swingers for as long as she could and wanted. After that, she came home and put the cat in the microwave oven, put the heads of all the roses, gouged the tires of her daddy's cat, pissed in her mother's swimming pool, and generally acted the, bitch. Because they loved her and were paying good money, they brought her back to the psychiatrist. It wasn't penis envy, said her father, without going into too much detail. Of that we should be absolutely sure. Well, if it wasn't penis envy, said the psychiatrist, it must be something else. Wait till I see. And he took a big leather-bound book down from the shelf.